Okay, I've just about 12 noon, and I want to welcome everybody to the lunchtime learning topic for the Family Financial Education Team. Today we're going to talk about assessment strategies. I want to first of all remind everyone, whether you're listening to archive or live today, that the materials for today's call are posted on the fyi.uwex.edu website, the /financial series area. And you'll find there a PowerPoint, which is posted both as a slide and as PDF. So you could take the slides version and adapt it if you wanted to use it for your own educational purposes or audiences. And then there's also the issue brief. So each month we're trying to do an issue brief that summarizes what I'm talking about, as well as, so again, that's a Word version and a PDF version, and you're welcome to take the Word version and adapt as you need to. Anybody have any trouble finding any of those materials for today? So hopefully folks have those. They were actually posted a little bit in advance, which is, I can't promise I'll do that always, but to the extent we can, we'll try to get those out in advance. Before I get started, any questions or comments? Okay, great. Well, today's topic is probably more than we can bite off in an hour-long call. So what my strategy, I think, is going to be to try to give you as much as an overview as I can of some terminology and some of the current writing that's out there around assessment strategies in financial education. Leave a chunk of time towards the end so people can ask some questions and clarifications, and I encourage you to stop me at any point in time to clarify. But, you know, this is probably a topic that we could go on and on about, and maybe we'll address with a future lunchtime learning call as well. The brief is brief, and so it touches on a lot of issues in a sort of somewhat cursory way. So hopefully I'll be able to clarify some of what's in the brief. And then the PowerPoint is really meant as a companion to both the call and the brief, and again, to give some tools that perhaps might be useful in working with different audiences about trying to understand some of these distinctions. Okay, so again, chime in if you need to. Otherwise, I'm going to go ahead and get rolling. So the topic of this session is really around assessment strategies. And you'll notice I use the term assessment very deliberately. An assessment you could think of as being different from evaluation. You can think of assessment as being different from impact measurement or other kinds of words that are out there. Assessment, I think of as being a very broad word to grab all kinds of different strategies you might be involved in, whether they are truly evaluative or more descriptive or something else. And so hopefully that'll become clear as we go forward. But regardless, I think the question that you all face on a regular basis is, how do I spend my time? What's worth my effort? How do I justify what I'm doing to the people I'm reporting to, or to my county, or to the committees that I'm working with? And so fundamentally, that's what we're after. We're trying to figure out ways that you can help make the case that what you're doing works, or help you decide that some of the things I'm involved in just aren't working that well relative to other ways I could spend my time, and I'm not going to spend my time on that. So assessment strategies can mean a wide range of activities. And so I want to be clear, and I'll probably say this a bunch of times too, that it's not that there's one way that's better than another, or one way that's superior to a different or different strategy. These are all different. They all have value in different ways. I think what happens oftentimes in not just an extension, but in all applied fields is, and even more in the social science field as well, just a lot of miscommunication about what we're trying to do and what the intent of different strategies are. So hopefully part of this too will help focus our language a little bit as we talk about various assessment strategies. You know, fundamentally, the question of does what we do work is extremely hard to answer, and one that at best we're trying to figure out ways to approximate impact or ways to talk about absolute levels of impact versus relative levels of impact or those kinds of things. So it's a very difficult thing to do, and it's very difficult to do with a limited time and resources. When if you were to really evaluate your programs rigorously, it might mean that you couldn't provide as much education, and I think, you know, by and large, people feel like they have some mandate to get information out there and work with people, and less so to be distracted by evaluative activities. So I think much of what I'll talk about too is sort of thinking about ranges of strategies along the continuum so that you really can do what makes the most sense in a focused way and still be able to continue to focus on the educational or outreach kind of work. You know, I think the most fundamental thing to think about as you're pondering a any kind of an assessment strategy is how you think the program might have impact. And sometimes in extensions, the term logic model is used, thinking about, you know, what is the chain of events that might occur to begin to have some impact on a person, something that the education might do. You know, there's lots of domains of outcomes, and we'll talk a bit about this, that you might be trying to measure, everything from knowledge to behavior to attitudes, those kinds of things. So it's regardless of what the outcomes that you're looking for are, you still have to think about this sort of basic logic model and what is it that happens in the big black box that is your program that might have some impact on people at the end. And then you have to think about how you measure it. You know, how do you measure where they were before and measure where they were after? And then think about whether you can really take credit for any change that might take place during that point in time. There's a figure that's in both the PowerPoint slides and in the brief where sort of has a little star figure sort of before and after, and whatever the measuring scale was, it doesn't really matter whether it's knowledge or something else. If they were an 8 and then they went to a 10 and the only thing they do is go through your program, then maybe you could claim that 2-point increase was due to your program. The problem is there's lots of other things that might cause that 2-point increase, and so it's very hard to attribute causality to that particular program. And that's really what bogs down a lot of the work in this area, is whether that change is real or not. Now, there's lots of other things that bog it down too, like can you actually measure an 8? What is an 8? What's the scale on which we might measure an 8? And can you measure it before and after with some reliability? Can you actually find people? So we have lots of issues around measurement. But even if we can measure it and reliably measure it, we still have questions about whether you can attribute the to that particular intervention. I think before we get too much into the strategies, though, or into the actual models that you might employ or strategies you might employ, it's important to think about what we have in terms of theory in financial education. And the truth is there is not a prevailing theory. There is no theory of financial literacy or theory of, you know, how people specifically acquire knowledge in the financial area. There are lots of theories in education about how people learn, cognitive theories and theories about how people even change behavior, but nothing specific in the financial area. And I get this question all the time. You know, what theory tell us about this or that? And the truth is that this just isn't a field that has a dominant theory. By and large, what we've done in financial education is borrowed from other fields. And most typically we borrow from health. Particularly, there's lots of literature, I wouldn't say lots, but there's some literature in the health field about how people change health behaviors over time, particularly how they stop engaging in negative behaviors like smoking or perhaps engage in positive behaviors like exercise or diet. And so there's a number of theories going back to the 70s about how people use information to make decisions about changing behavior, and then to the extent they can use that information to actually change their behavior. So they get the information, they realize something's wrong, they make a plan, they plan to do something different, they change their attitudes, beliefs, and then eventually they actually change their behavior. So this is a sort of variations on this are commonly seen in some of the financial education theory or financial education literature. I've reviewed probably about 40 or between 40 and 50 financial education papers that have been written over the last 10 or 15 years. Of those, most didn't have any discussion of theory. Those that did tended to use things like the theory of planned behavior or the trans-theoretical model, which attempt to try to look at this chain of events of knowledge, attitudes, including some level of social norms and intentions, at least with the trans-theoretical model. Other models like the theory of planned behavior are a little bit more flexible and are frequently cited as well, where you sort of think about information causing some sort of intention to change, and then that eventually results in some kind of actual behavior change. You know, these theories are relatively simple, and oftentimes it can be difficult to apply to the financial education setting, especially when you're talking about, it's one thing to talk about evaluating a program for a really risky behavior like smoking, or a very positive behavior like starting exercise or reducing diet, reducing total calories or going on a diet, something like that. When you talk about a short intervention, a financial education intervention, it becomes much trickier to think about the way that these theoretical models might be employed. So it is definitely a challenge to think about the theory side. The other important thing to know from the education theory or from the financial literacy theory is that we don't really have a standard by which you could measure. So we might all agree that there's a certain level of cholesterol that's not good, or a certain level of exercise which is so low that it's not good. It's not clear that we have a standard for financial literacy. You know, we've talked on these calls in the past about core competencies, about basic skills that we think people need to have. But how that might translate into a particular measure or a particular test score or something like that is not at all clear. So it's hard to say that we have a benchmark upon which we should really be tying people to. The other thing is that these behavioral theories, one of the weaknesses of them is that they often fail to acknowledge the fact that there's a difference between what we know and what we do. And you know that really gets at this whole issue of self-control. That you know that you should be saving more, or you should be dieting or doing something else, but it's just too hard to forego something today to get that gain in the future. So these sort of self-control breakdowns can intervene. And while people may have knowledge and may gain knowledge from various interventions, they don't, as a result, change their behavior. So that's an important distinction as well, to think about these personal issues that people have, and these issues of discounting and of self-control failures, that even though information may be conveyed, there may not necessarily be a change in behavior. The last thing to think about is we just don't have great measures in this field. We don't have a standardized financial literacy index, for example. We don't have a set of behaviors which are universally considered to be good or bad. A good example is that while most people may say that savings is always a good thing, there certainly are some people and populations for whom savings might not be a good thing. You think of somebody who's perhaps in a program where there's a lack of eligibility if you exceed some savings level. So you think about people in SSI or Medicaid, and they have these means tests where savings might actually knock them out of a benefit which might be worth tens of thousands of dollars a year to them. So it's hard to say universally that a particular behavior is a signal of being financially literate or financially less functionally literate. So it's also a challenge as well. I would say that the big distinction I would make, particularly for people in extension, as you're talking to people on campus or people who come from the academic research community, is evaluation has a very specific notion in social science research. And evaluation, the term evaluation implies some sort of causal impact, meaning typically with an evaluation, it means randomization. It means like a medical model, which is the gold standard in social science research, where people come in and we randomly assign them to a number, a one or a two. Ones get the treatment and twos don't. And, you know, it's that level of, and, you know, the best, the gold is, you know, the most rigorous standard of a causal model or experimental model would include not only random assignment of one group who gets it, but the other group who gets some kind of placebo. So in the medical community, you would get a sugar pill if you're in the placebo group, the control group, and you would get the actual treatment if you were in the treatment group. In social science research, this becomes very hard because the placebo is hard to craft. I mean, you could imagine a world where you would randomly assign people to financial education, but what does the control group get? They have to go sit in a room for 6 hours and do nothing. And sort of, how do you come up with a good placebo? So that becomes one challenge. And the other is that there are so many other factors that could intervene. And this is true in medical research as well. But, you know, with financial, particularly financial education, somebody who's engaged in financial education might be exposed to other kinds of things in the community, at home, at work, in the media, and et cetera, that might have some effect on them. So it's, you know, it becomes challenging to hold up this gold standard of evaluation of this sort of randomized experiment. Now, again, in social science, when folks talk about evaluation, they mean causal research, and they mean this level of a gold standard. And oftentimes what happens when people from outside of the social sciences come in and talk about evaluation, they're not really doing evaluation. They're doing more of what might be considered a descriptive analysis, where they've tracked some people in one group, tracked some other people in another group, done the comparison, and sort of claimed causality. And people in social sciences, that will, you know, really get them going. That's a good way to, if you're in a group of people in economics or sociology or whatever, and you sort of make these kinds of claims of causality without engaging in a sort of rigorous evaluation like a randomized experiment, it's just fun to watch, because suddenly everyone's all up in arms and say, oh no, you can't claim that, and you can't, here's 100 other reasons why we can explain why those results, why those differences might be different than what you claim it to be. Again, it comes down to the words that people use. But oftentimes evaluation is used in a non-social science setting to mean something which is more, you know, we tried to look at some impacts and we measured what we could, and it looks like it's generally positive, and so we feel good about that, which is fine. But people in social sciences would say that's not evaluation. You didn't have a counterfactual, is what they'll think about. You didn't have a valid comparison group. They'll say, compared to what? You know, what is the comparison to which you think is really valid? The biggest problem we have with evaluations which don't employ some sort of randomized design or involve some really rigorous statistical methods to try to control for differences between groups, and by really rigorous, I mean more than just the obvious gender and race and income and those kinds of things, but, you know, something about where they live and how it made it harder for one group to get the service to another, or, you know, some other non-obvious sort of way that people were broken up than the service, be it volunteering for the service or not. What we worry most about is that there are a number of studies which show that people who come for, particularly for financial education, but also for financial counseling, show strong selection bias. And what that means is the people who actually show up are different from the people who don't show up. And there's a wonderful set of studies that Stephen Meyer, who used to be at the Boston Fed, now is at Columbia, has done with people at tax sites, the volunteer income tax assistance sites, and offered them randomly to take part in a counseling or education session, and also got everybody to do a basic sort of discounting exercise where he was able to measure how patient they are, basically asking people would they rather have, you know, $50 now or $52 in a week, or $50 now or $60 in 3 weeks. And sort of, they went through various scenarios, and they actually got the payoff. So it was with real cash, and just found that people that were more willing to defer and wait for more money later were also the same ones who were more likely to come into the education. And the people who are more likely to say, I don't care how much money you want to give me in the future, I want it all now, was the least likely to come into the education. So we have this basic selection bias, and we see this in all kinds of programs. We see it in counseling as well, where, you know, you have either the best cases coming in, the people who are going to do very well regardless of whether they get education or not, or you have, in the case of counseling, the worst cases come in, people who are in dire straits and, you know, typically for whom no amount of intervention is going to be able to help them out. So it's that selection bias is the biggest issue, and the issue we always worry about, whether or not people look the same in terms of how they answer survey questions. There might be some things about them that are different, about their attitudes, about their motivation, about other situations that they're in that aren't obvious and yet can explain most of the difference between the two groups. And the selection bias is the number one problem with most of the research in financial education today. We can't rule out the fact that the differences between groups that are ascribed to the financial education aren't truly the result just of this selection bias, the fact that people who came were different from those who didn't. And it's one of the major problems of the field of financial education. We, out of those 40 or 50 studies I told you earlier, only 4 or 5 actually employ the rigorous randomized design, and about half of those didn't work out. So we have very few, 1 or 2 studies at most, which show any sort of effect that could be considered to be causal in the social science evaluation term. Now, assessment is, I think, a fairer term to use, because that doesn't raise the hackles of people in social science. You're not claiming causality. But assessment is critically important, and I argue what most of what we do in Accenture is assessment, and that's that we're trying to document the outcomes that either participants say that they achieve, or document outcomes that we think are proxies for the outcomes that we care about. So proxies for educational levels, financial literacy increases, or proxies for behavior changes. Now, we know that even if we have baseline and follow-up, we still don't really have randomization. But we can try to find comparison groups, you know, people who didn't take part in the program. And we can at least say that there are some differences between the groups. And we might even go so far as to claim that there's some association between the program and some of the outcomes. But we have to be pretty careful not to claim causality. If the program caused it, just the people who went through this make this particular claim, you know, that they feel better or they measure differently in some way, and that people who didn't go through the program didn't show that, and there's an association there, but not so go far as to claim causality. It's that really that claiming causality, I think, is problematic for people in social sciences, because they're very focused on how we measure, you know, the causal impact, and really think about that impact as being a, you know, a scientifically measured, rigorous term. Now, outcomes, I think you can say the term outcome is more associated with assessment. Outcome is more descriptive. It's something that we can measure and not necessarily have to feel like we're bound to the rules of a formal evaluation or a formal research kind of regime. So before I talk about more about strategies and domains and methodology, let me just pause there and see if anybody has any questions about this distinction between evaluation and assessment. So first I want to turn to just a bit about how we think about assessment design. And, you know, the first question to ask yourself is really, what domains do you want to measure? And there might be just between the domains that you want to measure and the domains that you can measure. But first, let's think about the domains that you want to measure. And I listed a few in the brief here. And so the one that I think comes to most people's minds is factual knowledge. Do people know more now than they did before they did the education? And factual knowledge typically means you test them on the content of the course before they do the course, and you test them on the content after they do the course, and you see some change in their level of factual knowledge. This means things like they answer true and false questions more correctly. They answer multiple choice questions more correctly. They're more likely to choose the correct response in each one of these items. Factual knowledge is tough to measure. You know, oftentimes the content that you teach may vary, depends on who's in the room that day. Factual knowledge sometimes is cut and dry, but oftentimes it's not. I mean, the issues of changes that might happen in programs or in policies, and even the fact that sometimes a certain product is more appropriate for one group than another, or even how you define terms might vary based on the context. So factual knowledge can be somewhat challenging to measure. A good example of that is many of you know about Jumpstart, which is a program to teach high school and college students about financial education. They've had a 35 to 40 question survey they've used for over 10 years. There's probably 4 or 5 questions on that list that if we were to go through that, people, you know, we might collectively have different answers on questions and good arguments about why our answer is right, because, you know, some of this can be somewhat subjective. You might think about particular cases when it makes sense to have a different strategy or a different answer that might be correct. So factual knowledge can be tough, but I think that's probably in some ways the steadiest ground, because usually you have some content that's consistent and that you could measure consistently over people. So after factual knowledge, then we get to perceived knowledge. And this is different from factual knowledge. And then we ask you, how much do you know about X, Y, and Z? How much do you know about mortgages? How much do you know about interest rates? How much do you know about investing? Now, it turns out this is actually not a terrible measure. It sort of measures how well people feel comfortable with topics and maybe how much exposure they've had to topics. One thing we know from previous studies is that people's perceived knowledge tends to be out in advance of it, that are factual knowledge. So I will tell you I know more about something than I actually answer correctly on a factual test. People tend to be overly optimistic about their level of knowledge, or they are, you know, incorrect about their actual knowledge level. That's okay, though, because it seems like there's some, you know, some value in knowing perceived knowledge. And so, you know, I like perceived knowledge questions. I think it's an interesting domain to look at. You have to be sort of careful about how you interpret results from perceived knowledge. One of the more important things to remember about perceived knowledge is that in some ways, the less you know, the more you overestimate what you know. So the biases that might be introduced with self-reported or perceived knowledge, you know, might be worse for a very low education level audience. You know, they might have even larger disparities between factual knowledge and perceived knowledge. But that said, I think it's a good measure and does tell you something about where people are at, even if their factual knowledge doesn't change, if they feel more comfortable with material that might be useful. The third category I would put out there is around attitudes. So this isn't necessarily what you know or what you think you know, but how you feel. And this becomes, in financial areas, a very important area, that the people who feel more stressed or feel less stressed, people who feel more confident or feel less confident, those can oftentimes be big drivers of how people actually behave. You know, one thing we sometimes see is that people will go through financial education and actually feel more stressed because they now know what they don't know, and they know they've got to do some things, and now they feel like they've got to get moving. So you have to be careful about interpreting too much about the direction on a measure of attitude or of stress or of confidence. But still, I think they're important to measure, and we do know that over time, as people get more confident to a point, obviously at some point they get overconfident, but to a point, the more confident that people can become and the more confident and you know, less stress they feel, those can be associated with more positive financial behaviors and general well-being. There's also not a whole lot of research in this area, but I think growing interest among researchers that suggests that people who feel less stress and who have better attitudes and better confidence in their financial abilities are less likely to engage in negative behaviors in other domains. So, you know, you might imagine if you're very stressed about your finances, you're not as good of a parent, or you're not as good of a spouse, or those kinds of things. So you might think about there's some ways in which less stress or more confidence or those kinds of things might result in better behaviors in other areas, not just in the financial area. So the fourth area is behavior, and I would break those down into two groups, self-reported behaviors and actual behaviors. Self-reported behaviors are, you know, if I ask you how much you have in your banking account, if you've paid a late fee, you know, did you pay all your bills on time, how much is your outstanding credit card balance, those kinds of things. Actual behaviors are when I get real data. So I get your credit report, or I get documents that you provide or that your bank provides directly to me. Obviously, we as researchers like actual behaviors better because there's no problem of bias that might be introduced by people providing a response that's maybe incorrect. Maybe it's, you know, they tell me the answer that they think I want to hear. Or, you know, maybe it's just that they just don't know. And so the numbers just aren't as accurate as they are in reality. A good example of the difference between self-reported behaviors and actual behaviors, if I ask people, how much do you have in outstanding, say, credit card debt or total debt, excluding a mortgage, you know, different ways of asking debt. But say one of my goals is to ask you how much debt you have. On average, people will tell me about half of what they actually have. So some of this is, you know, they forgot about certain debts, or there's certain things that are on the credit report as debt that they don't realize are really debt. And some of it is that they, you know, it's not something they want to disclose or not something they would admit either to the surveyor or to themselves. So that's an example. Other things people do pretty well on. So if I ask people, how good is your credit, and ask them sort of on a, you know, good, fair, poor, terrible kind of scale, people actually, you know, they put themselves in about the right bucket. You know, they generally will know if they're sort of generally good or generally bad along some kind of credit continuum. So some areas people do better than others. You know, income is another one where it can be pretty accurate depending on how it's asked. You know, if it asks a lot of details about different income sources and get clarity about whether it's taxes or not taxes or benefits and those kinds of things included. So they can be reliably measured, but it's still a challenge. And so there's many behaviors in the financial area that we might care about, use of different kinds of accounts or transactional accounts or those kinds of things, which we might even have a harder time measuring than we might through actual behavior. The problem with actual behavior is it's tough data to get unless you have a good relationship with a bank. And even then, you're only going to get it from one bank and not the person's overall portfolio. So then you're left with trying to get people to share their personal financial information documents with you, which is something most of us discourage people from doing. So it's challenging to try to come up with that data without a strong link to the financial institutions involved. And even then, it's difficult. Credit reports are probably one of the aggregators that have good information. And so, you know, more and more studies we see credit reports used because it's the closest we can come to a total picture. And even there, obviously, there's limitations of things that don't hit the credit report. And how you measure the credit and from what bureau and over what time period, those kinds of things all matter. But that continues to be an actual behavior that's common, more and more commonly used in studies in the financial literacy area. You know, the last thing I would throw out about all these measures is just thinking about measurements. And can whatever this thing is be reliably measured, and can it be valid as it's measured? By valid, I mean, is it really the truth? Is it, you know, do people have these biases or not? And then reliable is, you know, if I ask several times, do I get similar answers? So if I wanted to do, you know, a survey of people over time, am I just going to get variation because people answer these questions very unreliably, or is it actually pretty solid in that any changes might really reflect underlying challenges or underlying changes in behavior or knowledge? So this whole issue of validity and reliability is important, and whether the particular measure is really telling you what you think it is. So the next thing I think a little bit about is in terms of the actual design of the assessment. And sort of the classic design, I think, is you do some kind of measure before, and then you later on you do some kind of a measurement after. And we look at the change from pre and post as something that we might be able to say is associated with the program. And so, you know, that model has value. In terms of a non-experimental, non-evaluative sort of design, that's a good design because we know where people are at, we know where they are later, we'd like to measure that change. The problem with these models oftentimes is that people who are there at the beginning may not be there at the end. And it may be because they dropped out of the class, it may be because you did a follow-up survey later on by mail or by phone or by some other means. And so you get a bias in your sample in terms of who's still in. And what happens oftentimes is the people who were still in at the end are the ones that loved you and, you know, just sort of clingers on and hangers on. They want to be part of more programs. And, you know, the people who were, you know, very dissatisfied or who don't want to come back to another program or who are in more financial dire straits are the ones who we don't hear from. So it creates this bias. The only comparisons we probably do are between the people who were there both before and after. And the after group, we think it might be biased towards those who had more positive impact. So it becomes challenging with that model because we have to have low attrition on the follow-up. And that's always the big concern with these kinds of programs is there attrition in the follow-up, and is that attrition differential between different kinds of groups? Another kind of model is to just follow up with people, just do the after program. Follow up and see where people are at. And so one is just do an absolute level. Do people who come through the program, say 3 months later, are they happy? Do they, you know, do they ascribe some of their positive behavior to the course? In other words, to do it to the group that went through the course and then some other group, some group who didn't go through the course, and just compare the two and see if there's any differences between the two in terms of how they might answer questions or certain behaviors they might exhibit. So those are both potential ways to do that. You don't have to worry much about attrition. Although, again, the people who respond are going to be different than those who didn't respond. So you don't really know anything about the ones who didn't respond. But, it has potential. It works best if you have some sort of benchmark that you can compare them to. But it is a strategy. Again, you wouldn't necessarily be able to claim causality because you know there's some either observed or unobserved differences between these groups. But, it is a way to do one follow-up, and you can look at how people might associate for themselves the course or whatever the intervention was with their current state, whether it's knowledge or behavior. Reducing that pre and post just reduces your complications. It eliminates the attrition and certainly reduces the cost in terms of only having to do one survey instead of two. There is something called retrospective analysis where you can ask people for their perceptions of how the program impacted them. That's, of course, very simple, and it may not be worse than doing pre-post in some ways, and that you're still getting the same people who are there at the follow-up anyway. We always have to wonder about who responds, and we always have to ask this compared to what question. Are we really comparing to the right benchmark? But that's the other basic strategy that you can use is this retrospective kind of analysis. So the next thing I think about after we think about what do we want to measure and how do we want to measure it, when do we measure it, is the actual survey methodology, assuming it's a survey or other types of data collection. Are you talking about a survey where you are giving people a piece of paper and they fill it out, or is this an online survey? Does the information contain personal identifying information? And if so, then there's a whole issue of human subjects that we'll address in a minute. Human subjects meaning how you protect the personal information and any identifiable information about people. And I think then once you think about the model, you have to think about how long you're going to wait until your follow-up. So whether or not you're doing a retrospective design or a pre-post design, you have to think about whether do you want to measure it right at the end of the program, or do you want to give them some time to be able to act on the information they've been given and maybe change in their behavior. If you conduct a survey too fast, the information that you delivered may not have time to kick in. If you wait too long, they may not remember, or you may not be able to find them because they move around. So there's definitely a balancing act of when the right time is to follow the people, and it's never clear what that time is. It's sometimes as little as a few weeks, sometimes it's 6 weeks, 6 months, or a year, clearly after some point in time. Unless it's a major intervention, it becomes less and less likely you're going to find people or be able to plausibly say that it was the program that caused any changes over time. This distinction between paper and online, I think, is becoming less and less over time. We're beginning to see more and more surveys that are actually on smartphones, where people will answer four or five questions using text messaging or using an online smartphone device. So that's coming into the fore, although probably a couple of years out. For now, it's mostly whether they get an email and respond to an online survey, or they get a paper survey either on site or in the mail and respond to that. We on campus are currently using a lot of mail surveys. What we're noticing is that you can get a pretty good response rate on a mail survey for the investment, and you can, with a small amount of incentive, typically we're talking like $1 or $2 bills stuck in the envelope when you send out the first survey, get a pretty good follow-up as long as you do, some reminders. And those reminders might be postcards or actually sending out the survey a couple more times, but without money in them, to encourage people to respond. Things like using a stamp, handwriting the address on the front, offering obviously a stamp return envelope, those all can boost response rates. But it's not unusual to see a response rate of a low-income population of 30, 40, typically not over 50, but in that range with a relatively minimal investment. Online surveys can get good responses if the clients know you pretty well and have some trust in you. But people are pretty skeptical about online surveys, as you probably are with the ones that you get in your own email, as well as whether any incentives might actually come through or not. So there's some trust factors there as well. Now, one thing I would say about any kind of factual knowledge test that you might give to is, just be careful about whether it's you or somebody else who's teaching a course, knowing what the questions are in the survey and then sort of teaching to the test. We certainly do see that sometimes where results in the follow-up are, almost too good because it's been sort of honed into people, into the clients in the education setting that these are questions they'll be asked for later. So that's important. Again, obviously, response rate is an important thing to be careful of and to monitor. You can get better response rates with the kinds of things I talked about before in terms of the format of the survey and how you send it out. Sometimes response rates are quite low, and once response rates get below 10%, you have to really ask yourself about who responded and who didn't and how that might bias your responses, your results, and maybe make you think differently about whatever findings you have. In terms of the data itself and what you do with it, with an online survey, it's nice because basically you just download it. And in some cases, these online survey tools will do the analysis for you. You can sort of say what you want it to do, and it'll create charts and graphs for you, and it'll create comparisons from one group to another. So that's one of the advantages of the online data. Otherwise, and sometimes, I actually don't even use those tools. I end up exporting that data to something I can use on my computer. And if I do paper surveys, obviously I have to hand input it into something like Excel, a spreadsheet or something like that. And you can do almost everything you need with that. Basically, what you need is to create some charts and graphs and to be able to create means or averages. And what you really want to do is look at whether those averages are different from one group to another. If you have a really big sample, they probably are, but you can do something called a t-test to check that. And there's a link on the FYI site if you want to learn more about how t-tests are run. But essentially, we're just trying to figure out whether if group A got the service and they have a score of 8 and group B didn't get the service and they have a score of 6, is that 8 really different from a 6, or is that just noise around those two? And so that's what these statistical tests allow us to do, is to test for those kinds of things. You don't have to go overboard on the analysis, and oftentimes that's the kind of thing we can help with at the state level by connecting with the student. You can find a local student. Oftentimes, this isn't much above a freshman or sophomore level of statistics class in college, so it's not hard to find students locally or at the state that can help with this kind of thing. Particularly when you're talking about Excel sort of levels of data, not millions of observations and millions of questions that might need to be compared. I want to just touch briefly, because I know we're starting to run out of time, on the human subjects topic. Human subjects means protections for the people who you're collecting data from. And on campus, obviously, we worry a lot about human subjects. Every study that goes through UW-Madison campus has to have some human subjects protection review, meaning that we have an institutional review board who reviews projects on a monthly basis. Projects in medical sciences, projects in social sciences, projects in education, each has their own criteria and standards by which they evaluate projects. The worries that the university has is that anybody who's involved in a study might be treated poorly, or their information might be used without their knowledge. There have been many, many examples of people whose personal information has been used without their knowledge or used in a way that they didn't consent to, and that's concerning to researchers, in part because it discourages people from taking part in this research in the future, but in part because just the morality of using people for the researcher's gain without their consent and willingness to be part of that process. So this is a very common practice on campus, and typically a journal which is considering an article for publication will inquire about the human subject status of some research. Was there human subjects review before this data was collected? So people interested in publishing, it's something we have to worry about as well. So human subjects is something that's very much part of the research process. In extension, there is a human subjects review process and a similar IRB review process. What's interesting about evaluation, whether it's on campus or in extension, is it's considered in a sort of separate category. Assessment, particularly when you're talking about looking at outcomes, descriptive outcomes, is generally not considered research and may not even require IRB review. Now, that said, this is very much a gray area in terms of how the federal regulations treat human subjects in evaluation research. By and large, that one being other really good regulations that kick in will suggest some sort of a human subject review, even if it's private information, or I'm sorry, even if it's de-identified information. In other words, I can't tell in my data who specifically answered this or that. There still sometimes is a human subject review. The biggest thing that human subjects comes down to is, did the person consent to be part of the study or not? Were they able to voluntarily take part, meaning they could have taken part in the service but not taken part in the research? So they knew full well what they were getting into, and then they had the ability to bail out if they didn't want to. And then that is not coercive, and that's the biggest thing that human subjects worries about, particularly with when you talk about low-income populations or vulnerable populations. You know, did they feel like they had to consent to be part of this research, or did they really have the opportunity to bail out? And how rigorous was that opportunity? For most folks involved in engaged in the conduct of research in the way the IRB talks about it, they have to go through a human subjects training. It's just an online educational module. It's about an hour and a half in length, and it really just goes through the history of IRB and why it's important and these issues of consent and the voluntary nature of services and not having coercion. It's valuable to do. We require it of graduate students, anybody engaged in the research. And typically that's one of the things that human subjects might require, depending on the status. So let me just end and allow a little bit of time for some discussion here around this topic of communication. One of the places where most social science researchers fall flat is, what do they do with the results once they get them? So they'll work really hard to come up with measures that are reliable and valid and a design that meets the gold standard. And yet at the end, when a reporter says, so what do we make of your results, they really can't explain them in a way that can be communicated. And, you know, ultimately we're trying to do research that influences policy, influences people's behavior, that, results in behavior change that is positive. And if we can't, even if we can document it, if we can't communicate it in a way that gets into the hands of decision makers, then, it's not worth it. So thinking from the beginning about how things might be communicated, I think one thing Extension does well are things like the impact reports, where we already sort of have a model to use in terms of just talking about impacts or outcomes and communicating those to various audiences. There are different audiences, and each audience needs different levels of information. A reporter might need very general kind of levels. A policymaker might need general but some specifics regarding something that they're interested in. And then for the public, it's really, what does it mean for them and how does it affect them specifically? So oftentimes the communication strategies may have some tailoring depending upon the audiences that are of focus. This is just a quick thing to say that it's always important to leave some time in the beginning to think about how you're going to do communication. And that oftentimes means executive summaries or planning a particular conference or websites, those kinds of things, to get the information out in a way that can be really understood. So with that, I think I'll pause for a minute and see if anybody has any questions or comments or further follow-up. Anybody still out there?
Still here, just quiet.
Does this seem consistent with how you've thought about assessment, or is this...
Yes. Very much so, especially the challenges with it and getting it meaningful.
Michael, you might not have been aware of this, but all county faculty and perhaps even academic staff, I'm not sure about academic staff, in Extension are required to take that 1.5-hour online training on human subjects.
Great. The place where we often get tripped up is where we involve somebody else in the research, whether it's a volunteer or a student or somebody else. And typically they too have to go through it. And have folks had experiences going through the human subject review and Extension?
There may have been some that have had to. It depends on the degree of, in terms of questioning, most cases, simple evaluation or after meeting kinds of evaluation, we don't. But I know that some of the things we've done, like when we did the work on the reality simulations with youth, we did go through a human subjects process on that.
Any other questions, especially about this distinction between causality and non-causality?
Well, I don't have a question about that, but you were talking about what gets social scientists up in arms. And I know I've heard some go on about when an evaluation is not research and when it is considered research. Can you say anything on that?
Well, it's not a clear line about when evaluation is research and not. Generally, if there's an intention to make the information public, in other words, there's going to be a report that's going to be put out, and the report is going to be generalizable to a broad set of the population, then it might be considered research. If it's information about people in any case where it's mandatory, so the service was mandatory or the people engaged in it had no choice but to take part in it. So any vulnerable population, so the incarcerated, women who were pregnant are usually considered a special population, anybody under 18, those are all cases in which it's almost always going to need human subjects review. And even if they say, well, we don't consider it to be research, they still may insist on certain levels of standards being used. There is an exemption for educational settings, and so oftentimes I think that's what happens with extension work, is that it is considered in the educational context and therefore not considered to be evaluation research. Any other questions or comments? Okay. Well, I want to thank everybody. We're going to convene again in January and talk about homebuyer counseling, both pre-purchase and post-purchase. So a continuation of our counseling conversation we had, I guess it's over a year now, so it's not so much a continuation, but we'll get focused on that topic. We're assembling topics for 2011 as we go, so if anybody has suggestions, we're always flexible and can always substitute out and put in new topics. So just let me know, what are the hot issues that you want to focus on, and we'll get them on our list. Thanks a lot, everybody. Have a great week.